Welcome to the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Produced at the Recording Library of West Texas.
The selection you are about to hear today is part one. We'll conclude with part two next week. Hello, this is Michael reading from the archives of True West Magazine. December 1965 edition. Vinegaroon. True West presents the last half of the delicate operations of a first-rate scalawag. The Saga of Judge Roy Bean, Law West of the Pecos, by Ruel McDaniel. Judge Bean idly thumbed through a copy of the London Illustrated News, left at the saloon by some Canadian-Irish railroad worker. Suddenly, he sat upright. Then he moved the open magazine closer to his eyes and stared at a full-page picture. "By gobs!" he exclaimed to nobody in particular. "Ziggity! What a purty critter!" He tore out the picture and pasted it on the wall directly back of his judge's bench. The caption of the illustration told that the purty critter was Lily Langtry, then England's most famous and notorious actress. Born on the Isle of Jersey, she was called the Jersey Lily. It was shortly after this incident that Roy Bean erected the sign on his new building, and Lily Langtry inspired the name Jersey Lily, although the sign painter was over-liberal with the L's in the last name. That bothered Bean not at all. He cared little for technicalities, either in or outside his two bars. As the Irish workers came to the Jersey Lily, Bean called their attention to the picture. He asked endless questions. Now and then, he would encounter some man who had read about the actress, and the judge would hang on to his every word. He became an avid reader of the Illustrated News and all other publications which might carry pictures or stories about the Jersey Lily. Each time he found a picture or news item, he tore it out and pasted it on his wall. He subscribed to a New York theatrical weekly because Miss Langtry then was on an American tour and it carried frequent pictures of her. Soon he had the back bar as well as the wall back of his bench liberally papered with pictures of the Jersey Lily. His friends began to notice that Bean took more than the usual pride in his personal appearance. He started trimming his graying beard in the fashion of the Prince of Wales, later to become King Edward VII of England. He even built a crude opera house and hoped that he might persuade Miss Langtry to show in his town. A swaggering chap wearing city clothes drove into Langtry one day and stalked into the Jersey Lily. As he drank his beer, his eyes scanned the many pictures of the actress pasted against the back bar. "Who's that?" he asked. "The purtiest woman in the world," Bean replied. "Lily Langtry." "I've seen a much more beautiful," replied the fellow in store clothes. "In fact, she looks a little like a range heifer to me." There was a deep roar in barkeeper Bean's throat. Quickly, he removed his apron and walked from behind the bar. At the end of the bar, he asked a close friend, "How much you think he can fork up?" The advisor calculated that about $10 would be the limit. "You're under arrest for slander," Roy vehemently informed the stranger. "The fine is $10. You can pay now." Evidently, the newcomer had heard before of Bean's court and its odd dispensation of justice, for he reached into his pocket without hesitation. He handed Bean a $20 gold piece. "Give me my change, please." Bean blinked. He cast his eyes around at his friend. "The court made a technical error," he commented gravely. "So I reopen this here case, and I fine you $20. This court don't give no change." He tied his apron back around his waist and resumed his duties behind the bar. "Drinks on the house. What'll it be, gents?" Just as the judge dealt summarily with anyone who disparaged the name of his distant love, so did he appreciate any man who could give him the least bit of information about her. A cowboy, knowing this fact, profited thereby on an occasion quite momentous to him. The puncher drifted into Langtree, riding a cayuse whose ownership, it was alleged, had changed hands recently without knowledge or permission of the party of the first part. The real owner demanded the arrest and trial of the straggling cowboy. Bean opened court. "Hear ye, hear ye," the judge announced in deep intonations. "This honorable court is now in session, and if any hombre wants a snort, let him take it now. The charge against this Rainey is a capital offense, and the trial might be pretty drawed out. So the court will adjourn every 30 minutes for refreshments. Prisoner, stand up and face the court." Judge Bean often had read the expression, "stand at the bar of justice," and he translated it literally. Hence, no prisoner was permitted to sit during the trial. Instead, he was required to stand erect and at strict attention before the bench, regardless of how long the trial lasted. The first 30 minutes went to testimony of the alleged owner of the horse. He narrated how he had missed the animal and 2 days later had come upon the cowboy riding it. He named the identifying marks, which established, in his estimation, unquestioned ownership. One of the owner's hands took the stand and testified that the animal belonged to his employer and that the defendant took it without knowledge or consent of the rightful owner. Court adjourned 10 minutes for refreshments. "Gents, step right up to the bar," the judge announced. He strode back and donned his dingy flour sack apron. Things looked indeed black for the stranger, and nobody recognized the blackness of the situation more than he. His eyes went to the pictures of Miss Langtree, and his face perceptibly brightened. "That there sure is a fine picture of a mite purty actress," he commented, so that Judge Bean was certain to hear. "But it don't hold no light at all to the way she looks herself. Why, the night me and some of the boys saw her in Chicago." Bartender Bean's face beamed. He moved in front of the cowboy.
"You mean you sure enough saw her?"
"Yeah, me and the boys was up at Chicago delivering a trainload of cattle to the stockyards. We went to the Orpheum and saw her. The most beautiful woman in the whole damn world." Roy drew the prisoner aside. Here, for the first time, was a person who actually had seen his distant love. Here was a chance to hear of her charms from somebody who had actually drunk at the fountain of her beauty. The accused cowboy saw the effect his words were having upon the judge, and he was pleased. He spared no detail which would present the actress in a favorable light. He skimped no expression which would exemplify her beauty and charm. He talked constantly for fear that the conversation might lull and thus remind Judge Bean that a trial was in progress. Finally, after 45 minutes of Langtree praise, during which time most of the witnesses in the case had become quite well saturated with red eye, Roy concluded that it was time to dispose of the pending case. He intoned the court into session again. "By gobs," he announced after some silence, "there ain't nobody here that saw this young feller steal a horse. The prisoner's hereby discharged for lack of evidence, and that's my ruling." Eventually, Bean got enough courage to write to Miss Langtree. That she apparently ignored his first letter dampened his ardor not in the least. With that first letter written, he found it comparatively easy to write others. After 4 such messages of admiration, couched in tedious but dignified words, he concluded that he must do something a little off-range if he expected to make any progress toward ultimate consummation of his great love. So he conceived what he considered, in his quaintly vain sort of way, a brilliant idea. He wrote that, because of his great admiration for her, he had named his new town Langtree in her honor, and that he had called his new emporium the Jersey Lily to further honor the world's greatest and most beautiful actress. Of course,
naming the town Langtree had no connection whatsoever with the actress, which cunning old Roy well knew. But that made no difference with him. Certainly now was no time to stand on mere technicalities. This epistle brought forth an acknowledgement that the day the letter reached Langtree was doubtlessly one of the brightest days in Bean's whole life. He displayed the envelope to everybody. He hunted up neighbors who did not come to the saloon and showed it to them. The contents, however, he considered sacred. Nobody could read the letter. It came out, however, that among the things the actress wrote was that she was so deeply moved by the honors thus bestowed that it was her desire to show her appreciation in some tangible form. She suggested that a drinking fountain in the public square would be fitting, and that, with Bean's permission, she would proceed to have the fountain erected. Roy hastened a reply that he could not recommend the fountain, as much as he appreciated the offer. For, he explained, if there's anything these hombres of Langtree don't drink, it's water. "What's your name?" the law west of the Pecos demanded gravely. "Oscar Sweden, Your Honor," anxiously replied the angular, blonde-haired, raw-boned individual before the bar of justice. "What's your occupation, if any?" There shone a peculiar light in old Roy's eyes that promised no favors for the luckless prisoner. "For a fact, Judge, I don't have any. Come out here aiming to find a likely job. Your Honor, I can do anything." As I thought, Bean repeated scornfully. Another tramp imposing himself on the good people of Langtree. He glanced at the ancient law book on his table. "Drunk and disorderly, disturbing the peace and dignity of this fair city. Oscar Sweden, you sorry, good-for-nothing maverick, this court finds you guilty as charged, and I sentence you to 10 days at hard labor, and that's my ruling. Next case." 5 other prisoners before the bar that morning fared similarly, and this was unusual, for as nearly as possible, Judge Bean made all cases payable by fine. But as usual, when he veered from his normal routine, the judge had a reason. Now, it was an idea for improving and modernizing his service to thirsty patrons of the saloon. Now that the railroad was serving the town daily, more and more outsiders were patronizing his bar, and more of these customers were complaining of hot beer, especially during July and August. Time had been when bartender Bean could squelch any grumbling patron in much the same manner as he handled a stranger soon after the railroad came through. "Where's your ice?" the fellow demanded after taking the first swig of his beer. Roy eyed him up and down with a searing glare. "Where the hell you from, hombre?" "New York," the complaining customer retorted. "I thought so. Who else but a New Yorker ever heard of ice in July?" The proprietor of the Jersey Lily had made a deal with the San Antonio Ice Company to ship him ice at a fairly reasonable figure if he would take it in car lots. Bean figured he could do this if he had an underground ice house. Oscar Sweden and the other 5 prisoners were marked and branded to provide the manual labor for that house. Bean pressed a friend into service to handle the bar while he took charge of his prisoners and supervised the ice house job. He used his guns as pointers to direct the work, at the same time silently impressing his workers with the futility of escape. When it was too dark for further work, he drove his prisoners into a lean-to back of the Jersey Lily where he lived and fed and watered them. Then he directed them, at gunpoint, to a gnarled mesquite at the west end of the saloon. A heavy rusty chain, 12 feet long, was locked around the trunk of the tree. It stretched irregularly along the ground. At intervals, in the chain were iron cleats, vaguely resembling handcuffs. "Set down there, all of you," Jailer Bean ordered, "so I can lock you in for the night." He clamped the nondescript handcuffs around the wrists of his prisoners and bade them goodnight. It was a common thing to see one or two men chained to the old Mesquite, but six men lined up at once was something of a sight, even to Langtree, where it required a lot to arouse the interest of the average citizen. A few days later, a stranger with his collar worn backward got off the train and headed toward the Jersey Lily as Bean was locking up his workmen for the night. He witnessed the strange routine and made excited inquiry. "I'm ashamed and shocked at this inhumanity of such a thing," he protested. "You treat human beings like so many cattle." Bean walked up to him. "Parson," he began solemnly, "is there anything healthier to a man or beast than fresh, invigorating air and sunshine?" "Well, no, not that I know of," the stranger answered, puzzled. "But I was speaking of these poor wretches." "I was getting around to them. I keep these men out in the sunshine all day. That's good for 'em, according to your own admittance. There's no pure air under the canopy of the skies than this rich, nourishing air of the Pecos. At night, the men are out here where they can get all of it they can breathe. What more could they ask?" The parson was puzzled for a second. "But sleeping on the ground like animals," he then managed uncertainly. "Everything that nourishes man or beast springs from the ground, stranger. If the ground's so terrible, why is that?" "Shucks, parson, it ain't so bad. If the nights turn off cool, as they sometimes do out here in these hills, why, I give 'em toe sacks to lay their heads on, providing they've done a good day's work. They ain't complaining." The old Mesquite was the only jail the law west of the Pecos ever had, but it served its purpose. Cattle rustlers, murders, and other capital offenders were bound over here until arraignment for trial, and if a case dragged out into a second day, the Mesquite served as a lockup overnight. Minor offenders also were cuffed to the heavy chain, either to remind them of the gravity of their predicament or to impress others with the seriousness of violating Judge Bean's laws. Oscar Sweden took his job seriously. He made frequent suggestions toward improvement of the ice house, and by the third day, Bean was relying considerably upon him to guide the labor of the other five prisoners. On the fifth day, he made Oscar a trustee. That released him from the chain at night and gave him the run of the premises. By the end of his 10-day sentence, Oscar had become a valuable aid to the busy proprietor of the Jersey Lily. "Sweden," Roy propositioned upon completion of the Scandinavian's term, "you say you really was looking for a job when you come over here in this country?" "I was at that, Judge. Still am," Oscar answered with solemn tone. "I was thinking I could maybe use you around the Jersey Lily if you want to stay. Course, I didn't mean you any harm sentencing you to 10 days. You saw how it was. Somebody had to build that ice house." And thus, Oscar Sweden became a friend and loyal assistant to the law west of the Pecos, ever capable at either end of the combination saloon and courthouse. "Judge," a cowboy announced, "we found a dead Mexican down here at the mouth of the Pump Canyon. The boss says maybe you oughter hold an inquest." Bean removed his apron, walked from behind the bar to his judge's bench, and there donned a long black alpaca coat. "Certainly, my boy, sure. Show me where." He had set himself up as law and order west of the Pecos, and he found no little pride in pointing out that no dispensing job within his jurisdiction had stumped him, either legal or liquid. Inquests seemed to him rather needless things, especially if there was no fees in sight. But if the ranchers wanted them, why, he was the judge who could hold them. The cowboy led him down into the maze of Pump Canyon. Stopping beside an iron-colored boulder, he said, "Here's your man, Judge, and a fine mess he's in." Bean made a perfunctory examination of the remains. A bullet hole showed directly in the center of the deceased forehead. Bean cleared his throat and declared the inquest officially opened. It's the finding of this court that the Mexican, name unknown, came to his death by being shot in the head by an unknown person who was goddamn good shot. He searched the pockets of the dead man but found nothing, so all he got out of this service was the experience. However, not all inquests were so fruitless. There was the case of the railroad laborer, for example. News came to Langtree that a workman had fallen off a railroad trestle and killed himself. Bean was asked to hold an inquest. He proceeded with courtly dignity to the scene of the tragedy. He searched the body of the victim and found a revolver and $41 in cash. "It is the duty of this court," he declared, "to confiscate this here concealed weapon, which is a damn good gun, because it's legally against the law to carry a gun, especially a dead man. And in view of evidence, I find it the court's duty to fine the offender 41 simoleons for carrying concealed weapons, and that's my ruling." By this time, Judge Bean had taken the time to obtain his appointment as Justice of the Peace, this expedient apparently to be advisable in view of the fact that Valverde County had been organized and Langtree was a part of the new county. It was only 67 miles to the new county seat, so the judge felt that things should be a little more in order. News of this unorthodox disposition of a dead man and his worldly goods filtered over to Del Rio, Valverde's county seat. There was talk of ousting Bean for irregularities in office. A rancher brought news of this threat back to the judge. "Hell, they can't do that," he expostulated. "It ain't legal. They ain't nobody complaining except the county attorney and the judge. They're bellyaching on account of not being able to grab that 41 bucks for themselves. I tell you, Sam, you got to temper justice with common sense. Now, take them Del Rio fellers. What would they have done in this case? I tell you what, they had dragged out the matter in a whole lot of legal terms and ended up by taking the $41 and the gun for administration fees. So what's the difference? Me? Well, you know yourself, I give the poor devil a decent burial. Instead of rolling him in a blanket and throwing him in a holler place in a rock and covering him with mesquite, why, I hired a hack and hauled him down to Langtree. There, I hired a preacher for a peso to orate a decent funeral. Then I hired two Mexicans. Well, not exactly hired them because they was my prisoners, to dig a regular grave and bury him like a white man. I'm pretty sure the poor devil himself would have thanked me for it. Eventually, the county attorney did come over to Langtree to investigate the conduct of Bean's court. "You're violating the law by failure to make a report of your proceedings and fees of office," the young barrister told the judge. "Young man," Roy replied curtly, "this here court is self-supporting. Whenever it can't take in enough dinero to pay its way, I'll get in touch with you." Suicides, accidental deaths, murders, assaults, cattle rustling, horse thieving, petty disorders, plain drunks, marriages, inquests, divorces, christenings, first aid, and civil suits all came under the elastic jurisdiction of Judge Bean's court. The ranchers soon learned that he was their most powerful ally, and they cooperated to the fullest. At his bar of justice, they could obtain lightning action, while if they went to a more formal court, there might be changes of venue, delays, rehearings, and a dozen other legal tangles to delay the ends of justice. Outlaws feared the crude court as much as the law-abiding citizens appreciated it. Thus, in spite of the fact that Judge Bean did not conduct his court along orthodox lines, state and district authorities generally took a passive view of his methods because he had established, after a fashion, some kind of law beyond the Pecos. That was more than anyone else had dared attempt before. At first, Roy acted as arresting officer, prosecutor, defending attorney, jury, and judge. Thus, he reasoned, he cut down materially the costs of court. Gradually, however, as more settlers and outlaws moved in, business grew and the procedure became somewhat more technical. Although invariably, under protest, Judge Bean would permit a defendant to hire an outside lawyer if he insisted long and strong enough. Nevertheless, the law west of the Pecos considered such action a personal affront. On one such occasion, the court was solemnly ready for action. A railroad man, a newcomer in the community, and therefore excusable for his audacity, was charged with a grave crime, and he had hired a lawyer from San Antonio to defend him. The lawyer introduced himself at the outset by objecting to the whole court procedure. "You have no authority in this case," he cried. Judge Roy squinted his cold blue eyes. He thumped one of his guns against the top of the table. "Sit down," he commanded. "You have no jurisdiction in this case, and I demand constitutional rights and protection for my client." The law west of the Pecos glared at the young lawyer. "Oscar," he called over to his assistant, who acted as barkeeper and constable during rush hours at either bar. "Come over here. In about 8 minutes, I expect to find this here prisoner guilty, and I order you and the boys to take him out and hang him. Whatever you intend to do." "Take him out and hang him, of course," Oscar answered without hesitation. "Supposing," Judge Roy went on, "I decide you better hang his lawyer along with him. Then what would you do?"
"Why, hang him, Judge. It ain't no more trouble to hang two than one."
Bean turned his attention back to the young lawyer. "Ain't that enough jurisdiction for you? Now, young jackleg, you sit down. I'm the law west of the Pecos. I run my court the way I see fit, and that's my ruling." Penalties imposed in this crude bar of justice ranged all the way from a round of drinks for the house at the expense of the defendant to hanging. Judge Bean did not believe in penitentiary sentences. That involved a maze of technicalities into which the state of Texas entered, and Bean did not care for that. He imposed his own penalties, as his own quixotic sense of justice dictated, and he did not wish to impose anything which he could not personally carry out. This particular defendant's sentence was a $100 fine, which he paid with an obvious sigh of relief, coming close upon the heels of Judge Roy's demonstration of the court's interpretation of jurisdiction. "Oscar," Judge Roy said to his lieutenant one morning, "Carter's trying to cheat me out of my half of them goats we've been raising under contract. Take this here sequestration writ, go over there and show it to that double-crossing coyote, and drive my half of the goats to my corral." Roy had entered into an agreement a year before where Carter would raise goats from Bean's herd on shares. Now he contended that Bean's share had died. Roy would have preferred to go over personally and escort his goats back under the protection of his 2 6-guns, but he had set himself up as law west of the Pecos. He demanded that other citizens settled their civil differences according to Pecos law, and he proposed to do likewise. Oscar delivered the goats as ordered and locked them in the Bean's corral. The judge then called court to order. "It appears that the stock in question was seized by a duly authorized officer of this court, to wit, Oscar Sweden. It further appears that the animals was impounded according to law in the complainant's corral for safekeeping. That being the status, I hereby dismiss the case, and that's my ruling." On occasions, however, he became impatient even of his own rapid-fire justice. An operator of a lunch stand across the street owed him $3.75 for beer bought 6 months before. Repeatedly,
Barkeeper Bean had demanded payment. The debtor continued to put him off. Finally, Roy removed his apron, donned his guns, and walked across the street just at lunchtime. The stand was filled with hungry customers. Bean unholstered his revolvers and established himself directly in the door of the eating house.
"Don't get excited, gents," he explained to the wide-eyed customers. "I'm just here to collect an old account. You can pay right here as you leave."
He counted the check of each customer until he had in his hand $3.75 due. Then he holstered his guns, thanked the blubbering proprietor, and invited the nervous customers to come over and have drinks at the Jersey Lily. On the house.
Hear ye, hear ye. This honorable court's now in session. And if any galoot wants a snort afore we start, let him step up to the bar and name his prison. Oscar, serve the gentleman.
Thus did Judge Roy Bean open court to try one Carlos Robles, an opening typical of his usual procedure.
"Carlos Robles," he said solemnly, after witnesses and hangers-on had downed their liquor, "it is the finding of this court that you are charged with a grave offense against the peace and the dignity of the law west of the Pecos and the state of Texas, to wit, cattle rustling. Guilty or not guilty?"
Not being able to speak or comprehend English, Robles merely grunted.
"Court accepts your plea of guilty. The jury will now deliberate, and if it brings a verdict short of hanging, it'll be declared in contempt. Gentlemen, is your verdict ready?"
The 12 nondescript citizens cleared their throats in unison.
"It is, Your Honor," several spoke. "Thanks, gentlemen. Stand up, Carlos Robles, and receive your sentence. You got anything to say why judgment shouldn't be passed on you in this court?"
Of course, Carlos had not, in view of the fact that he had only the vaguest idea of what was transpiring.
"Carlos Robles," Judge Roy continued, his voice almost quaking with the solemnity of the occasion, "you've been tried by 12 true and good men, not men of your peers, but as high above you as heaven is of hell, and they've said you're guilty of rustling cattle. It's the order of this court that you be took to the nearest tree and hanged by the neck till you're dead, you olive-colored son of a billy goat."
The law west of the Pecos could be cruel in administering his brand of justice, but he was cruel only when he deemed the accused and the crime fully warranted such cruelty. He more frequently tempered justice with his own peculiar brand of mercy, especially if there was any means by which he could profit by that mercy. One afternoon, several ranchmen brought in a 20-year-old boy accused of horse stealing. They demanded that he be tried and dealt with according to the enormity of the crime. Judge Bean duly opened court. He appointed 6 men as jurors, the actual number meaning nothing to him and depending entirely upon men available. He would not appoint just any citizens to jury duty. They had to be good customers of the liquid bar at the other end of the shack during intermissions, or their services as jurors no longer were desirable or acceptable. Every transaction was designed to return the utmost in profit, and non-drinking jurors were strictly dead timber.
"Hear ye, this honorable court is again in session. Anyone wishing a snort, have it now. This here prisoner is charged with the grave offense of stealing a horse. Oscar, where are the witnesses?"
The law west of the Pecos opened. He appreciated his own sense of humor in varying his court openings to relieve the monotony, but he seldom varied to the extent of omitting the invitation to participate in a snort at the other bar.
"We caught him in the act of stealing the animal," the ranchman testified. "He admitted his intentions."
"That right, young feller?
You was stealing the cayuse?
The young prisoner dropped his head, unruly red hair tumbling down over his high forehead.
Yes, Your Honor, he mumbled.
Gentlemen of the jury, the judge instructed, the accused pleads guilty to horse theft. You know as well as I do the penalty. I'm ready for your verdict.
And it was promptly forthcoming. Gravely's sentence was passed.
If there's any last word or anything, I'll give you a few minutes,
he told the pale Easterner, thus extending an infrequent favor.
I would like to write a note to my mother back in Pennsylvania,
the doomed prisoner said slowly, with obvious emotion.
Thank you.
Oscar, fetch the prisoner a piece of wrapping paper and a pencil. I think we got a pencil back there behind that row of bottles.
Bean gently handed the convicted thief these writing facilities, then got up and tendered him the beer barrel and rickety table from which sentence had just been passed. He took a position directly behind the boy so that he could watch over his shoulder at what he wrote. The victim wrote at length an apology for the grief and trouble he had caused his mother and earnestly sought her forgiveness.
In some small part, perhaps, I can repay you the money I have cost you in keeping me out of trouble. Enclosed is $400, which I've saved. I want you...
Judge Bean started, cleared his throat, cut in at this point. By gobs, he exclaimed. Gentlemen, I got a feeling there's been a miscarriage of justice in this case. I hereby declare it reopened. Face the bar, young man.
The prisoner removed himself from the beer keg and stood erect in front of the judicial bench, befuddled at this sudden turn.
After all, that wasn't much of a cayuse the lad tried to steal, and he didn't actually steal him, so I rule it's a finable case. I hereby fine the accused $300 and get to hell out of this county before I change my mind.
The boy gladly enough paid $300 of his $400 and assured the court that the next setting sun would find him well beyond Del Rio Pecos. Practically every cattleman and law-abiding citizen of Bean's Bollywack had an indefinite appointment as deputy constable to the law of the west of the Pecos. Thus, any citizen who apprehended any person in the act of committing a crime or suspected any of crime, had authority to bring him in forthwith for trial. Bean consistently encouraged such cooperation, for the more business they brought before the court, the greater the financial returns for the whole establishment. Naturally, it was understood that such arresting constables did not in any manner participate in the fee accruing from such cases created by them. This, doubtless, was the only justice court in the state of Texas wherein only one official received all fees collected by the office. Under his authority as deputy constable, Reb Wise, Pecos rancher, brought in a cattle rustler on a hot August afternoon when business at the refreshment counter was exceptionally brisk. It was all both Roy and Oscar could do to handle the trade. Consequently, Bean looked up with a sour expression when Deputy Constable Wise approached the bar and informed the judge that a prisoner was awaiting attention at the bar of justice.
"What's he charged with, Reb?"
Roy asked, opening another foaming bottle of Triple X beer.
"Cattle rustling, Your Honor," Reb replied. "Whose cattle?"
"Mine."
"You positive he's guilty, Reb?"
"Positive. Why, Judge, I caught him with a running iron on one of my finest calves," the rancher replied with emphasis.
For the first time, Roy glanced up at the scowling prisoner. He noticed blood dripping from his left ear.
"Who plugged his ear?" he inquired.
"I did, Your Honor, when he wouldn't stop."
"You oughtn't have shot at his head, Reb. You could have killed him, and that would have been bad, because he wouldn't have been saved for the punishment he deserves. You real sure he's guilty?"
"Didn't I say, Judge? I caught him running a brand on my stuff."
"All right, then," said Bean.
"What'll it be for you, feller?" to a newcomer at the bar. "All right, then. The court finds the accused guilty as charged, and as there ain't no worse punishment I know of right handy, I hereby sentence him to be hung. Reb, I'm busy as hell here. You and some of your compadres take him out and tie his neck to some handy limb someplace where his cronies will be positive to see him. And that's my ruling. Court's adjourned. And what'll it be for you down there, Slim?"
"Señor Bean, my hombre, he sick. I'm hungry. Could you, judge, please give me medicine for him? And maybe some food? I work for you. My fianna."
A stoop-shouldered Mexican woman stood in the doorway of the Jersey Lily, her gnarled hand extended, a dingy shawl around her head. A wrinkled, chocolate-colored face bespoke more tragically than her words the desperate hunger that gnawed at her insides. Roy Bean wiped his hands on his soppy apron and walked from behind the bar. He plodded across the floor beyond the poker tables to a row of dust-caked shelves. He removed a bottle of patent medicine. From a lower shelf, he gathered 4 cans of beans. He then strode to a barrel and scooped up a paper bag full of meal.
"Here you are, Raquel. I hope Tomas feels better soon. Come back if you need anything."
He spoke in a tone foreign to his customary gruffness. Stalking back behind the bar, he wrote down with tedious calculations some figures on the wall below a big picture of Lily Langtry. That afternoon, a beer salesman from San Antonio arrived. "Beer's on me," the drummer announced, in keeping with the long-established custom. Roy was well aware of this custom. In fact, he promoted it at every opportunity. And he was prepared on short notice to summon his friends and the hangers-on of Langtry through devious grapevine communications. Within 10 minutes, the front of the Jersey Lily was jammed with thirsty citizens partaking liberally of the beer man's hospitality. For a friend to neglect to partake of this outside salesman's hospitality was considered by astute Roy a direct affront to him and a strain on the ties of friendship. If a man did not want beer, then it was his duty to Bean to accept the beer as proffered and dispose of it according to his own ingenuity and the dictates of his conscience. Ordinarily, he maneuvered such customers to the far end of the bar, where they might pour the contents of their beer bottles into wide-mouthed cuspidors without notice from the genial salesman. Along with encouraging beer salesmen to perpetuate this delightful custom of treating all present to free beer, Bean also had formulated a unique system of calculating the amount of the final bill. According to this plan, the bar could not lose. If the salesman came out short now and then, that was his problem. Barkeeper Bean had enough to do in protecting his own interests without worrying unduly over the possible losses of San Antonio beer drummers. As each beer bottle was emptied and returned to the bar, Roy and Oscar would slide it to one end. Here, the empties accumulated against the time when the treat was over, and the salesman settled his account. On this particular day, a close observer could have seen the industrious proprietor of the Jersey Lily reach down under the bar when he caught the salesman looking the other way, and ease an empty out to join the growing pile at the end of the bar. The observer would have noticed that old Roy kept strict count of these stray empties as he smuggled them into the legitimate pile. Finally, he smiled benevolently to himself, reached over and rubbed out the figures he had written under the large Lily Langtry picture under the departure of Raquel. He paid no further interest to the empties under the bar and turned his attention exclusively to the comfort and well-being of his patrons. "Well, how much I owe you, Judge?" the salesman asked. "By gobs, they nicked you powerful heavy this time, Sam, but I guess you can stand it. Here's the empties. We'll count 'em." Roy picked up the bottles one by one and returned them to the cases, counting aloud to check with the salesman. "That one there?" Sam questioned. don't look fresh to me. It wouldn't be a stray, would it, Judge? In feigned surprise, Roy picked up the questionable empty and held it between him and the light. Does look dry, he admitted, but it's just some of the boys' way of drinking. They don't get good beer often, and when they do, why, they not only drain the bottle dry, but they sop it out. Pretty good vouch for your beer, Sam. In spite of his queer sense of justice, in some cases, Roy Bean was in genuine sympathy with the underdog, even if it cost him money to take the part of such a person. He eventually became not only the legal advisor, but physician, godfather, and spiritual guardian of the poor Mexicans who lived in their humble, inoffensive way around Langtree. Billy Dodd, Langtree's merchant and Bean's closest friend and only confidant, asked him one day after he had given his own hot lunch to a crippled tramp why he was so liberal in helping such folks. Especially, Dodd added, considering the way you steal from some others. Roy's blue eyes twinkled. It delighted him for his friends to call him a thief and reprobate. Well, I ain't been any gol dang angel myself, and I don't guess I'll ever change my ways much. So there might be a lot charged up against me on the big day. On these premises, I figure what little good I can do in helping these poor devils. Why, the range rider up there will sort of give me credit for it when the time comes. It was the first and only time Billy Dodd, or anyone else, ever heard Bean speak seriously of a hereafter or religion. A minute later, he reversed his sentiments by exploding. Ah, hell's katooey, Billy. I don't believe a goddamn word of that. I must be getting old and skittish. Rain was coming down in a slow drizzle, with the norther even now showing its blue nose behind the rolling gray hills. Most of the ranchers were busy driving their sheep and goats to cover, and no strangers were in town. Business was dull at both ends of the Jersey Lily. Judge Bean liked such days because they enabled him to take time out for poker. Now he sat at one of those two poker tables, playing with Dodd, a cowboy from El Capitan Ranch, and a ticket agent. Oscar, trot over and see if we got any mail on the 1 o'clock train, Roy directed. 5 minutes later, Oscar slushed in and handed the law west of the Pecos a letter bearing a foreign stamp. Roy tore it open with avid contemplation. He had never seen a stamp like that, and the feminine handwriting itself bore a foreign touch. He squinted at the contents with puzzled expression. He knit his wide forehead and stroked his cropped beard. Here, Billy, read it for me. This light over here's bad, he muttered. Dodd glanced at the letter and smiled to himself. It was written in German, but Roy would not admit his inability to read even that foreign language. It's from a woman in Germany, Dodd explained. Bean's eyes glittered with interest. What does she say? He urged. Says she has a son who was supposed to have been a soldier and stationed somewhere near Langtree. He was killed in action, and she says she can get compensation from the government if she can prove his death. Judge Roy cleared his throat and resumed the poker game. 2 days later, he went down to Dodd's store. Billy, he said casually, I want you to make out an affidavit for me about that German lady's son. You write down what I tell you. Bean then dictated a long and minutely detailed account of the exemplary life of the soldier, and in glowing terms, exactly how the boy had died on the field of honor, standing off the onslaught of murderous savages while his comrades escaped to safety. He described the beautiful military funeral, in respect of which the whole town closed its doors and repeated the words of the army chaplain as he bequeathed the mortal remains to the great general. To this statement, he affixed his signature and imprinted the seal of his office. Funny, remarked Dodd. The fellow must have been a pretty close friend of yours. I never heard you speak of him. Hell, snorted the law west of the Pecos. I never laid eyes on the goddamn tramp. For all I know, he was never in 1,000 miles of this place. But that don't make any difference. The poor lady needs help, and I'd do that much for any woman. Besides, the government can spare the money. Roy Bean's admiration and respect for women was not merely superficial. It was much deeper than that. In his earlier days, he had had many affairs with beautiful women, but none had left any appreciable impression. They were merely a part of that beckoning adventure which lured him over onto the lands of danger and excitement. But in San Antonio, after the Civil War, he met a girl who was more than just another delicious adventure. She was Virginia Chavez, a young Mexican woman of exotic beauty and charm, and a descendant of one of the most aristocratic Canary Island families who settled San Antonio late in the 17th century. Until then, marriage was only for followers of the prosaic life and for old men who sat in rocking chairs. Now it was for him. Soon he married Miss Chavez, settled on the outskirts of San Antonio, and started in business. 2 sons and 2 daughters were born. There was, however, that inevitable clash of temperament and viewpoint. She was refined, cultured, and sensitive. He, crude, wild, adventurous. As the breach between Roy and his wife widened with the years, that taunting call of the untamed West echoed louder and louder in his imagination. His wild spirit strained under the subduing lease of civilization and superficial culture. Roy longed again for the open spaces, the friendship of the stars blinking down at him upon the untamed prairie, and for the fear of the trigger, the smell of battle smoke, for the time when, again, he would be a law unto himself out there in the wasteland where every man carried his life and law and hopes swinging from his hips and in the cold glint of his eyes. Finally, when news came of the building of the railroad into the uncharted land beyond the Pecos, he could restrain that spirit no longer. The breach between him and his wife had reached the breaking point, and in the Trans-Pecos, he sensed asylum from domestic troubles as well as a new life after the manner of his longing. "How much?" inquired the meticulous Easterner. He tilted his brown derby farther to the left and inspected himself through the speckled mirror of the back bar. 4 bits, bartender Bean answered sourly. The customer flicked a dust smudge from his coat sleeve, then extracted a $5 gold piece from his hip pocket wallet and clanged it down on the counter. Bean tossed the piece into the handmade cash drawer. "What'll it be, Herb?" he asked a customer at the other end of the bar. "Say, fellow, how about my change?" the Easterner demanded. "Change?" Bean answered innocently. "What change? Don't you ever know this here establishment never gives change? What'd you say yours was, Herb?" The tenderfoot reddened. His jaws puffed in much the manner of an aggravated horned toad. "Look here. You give me my change, you thieving son of... I arrest you, stranger, for using abusive language and disturbing the peace of this city. I'm the law west of the Pecos, and consider court now in session. I fine you $4.04, and get the hell out of here before I lose my temper." The customer got. With the coming of the railroad and the daily train stops directly in front of the picturesque Jersey Lily, the Emporium did a thriving business on cases of this kind. If Bean did not like the looks of a passenger, temporarily quenching his thirst at the bar, no change was forthcoming, regardless of the size of the bill or gold piece proffered. Whether such a customer laid down 50 cents or $20, it was the same. In Judge Bean's view, the money was taken by due course of law, and whether or not the victim agreed with the findings of this queer law, there was no court of appeal. The law west of the Pecos was the court of the first and last resort, with Judge Colt always sitting in to concur in Judge Bean's rulings. A favorite trick of Roy's was to delay taking a train passenger's money until the whistle blew and the train started to move away. When the customer would yell frantically for his change, the judge would drop the money and pretend not to find it. Finally, the exasperated customer would be forced to dive toward the departing train without his change. One customer failed to carry out his part of the usual procedure. When Bean failed to hand over the amount due out of a 20, the customer stood in the door of the Jersey Lily, calmly watched the train depart, then came back to the bar and faced the proprietor. "Now, by God, you give me that change, or make room for me to live in this dump till I've boarded out the money. You can suit yourself. I don't have any place to go anyway." Roy appreciated the humor of the situation, handed the stranger his correct change, and ordered drinks on the house. He put up the customer for the night, and by the time the next train arrived, they were real friends. Bean despised a tenderfoot who pretended knowledge of the West. He looked sourly upon any poser, regardless of the occasion. "What'll it be, mister?" Oscar Sweden asked a tow-headed young chap standing before the bar admiring himself in the dingy mirror. The stranger's new Stetson brim was at least 2 inches wider than the accepted size in the West at the time. The band was a quarter size too large. The crown was pinched to a point. And the whole effect gave the newcomer a ludicrous appearance, of which he was wholly unaware. He adjusted the bright silk kerchief around his neck at a swaggering angle and hitched up his brand new leather chaps with conchos liberally dotting the outer edges. "Give me a shot of pison," he answered out of the corner of his mouth, slamming his booted foot upon the bar rail. He naturally expected a drink of 40-rod whiskey, and the bartender reached for the bottle. "Hold on there, Oscar," said Bean, who had overheard the order and already was eyeing the new customer with an expression which might have been inspired by a severe bellyache. "I'll take care of that order. You look after this end of the bar." On the 2-foot shelf, constituting the back bar, were 3-quart fruit jars. In each were preserved in alcohol, typical specimens of the denizens of the Trans-Pecos. Several tarantulas, a vinegaroon, small rattlesnakes, and a Gila monster. Acting in a matter-of-fact manner, as though it were a regular part of the daily routine, Bean reached back and grasped the jar containing the tarantulas. He placed a whiskey glass on the bar in front of the swaggering stranger, unscrewed the top from the fruit jar, and poured the glass full of the preserving liquid. Without a change of expression or tone, he said, "There's your pison, feller." The customer, who had been watching the procedure with growing concern, glanced once at the glass and shoved it back. "Give me a drink of whiskey," he commanded. Bartender Bean reached under his apron and brought up his long-barreled 45. He drew on the surprised customer. "You ordered pison. Now, goddamn, you drink it." The stranger paled perceptibly. I don't believe I want a drink, but I'll pay you for it, if it was any trouble to you." He started to back away. Bean gripped his gun and threw down on the thoroughly subdued tenderfoot. "Liquor pison or lead pison? Have your choice." The young fellow grinned in a silly manner through paling lips. A trembling hand moved out and grasped the glass. He raised it toward his lips. "Wait a minute," Roy commanded. "Set that stuff back down. Next time you come to the Jersey Lily, be yourself. Don't pull any of your Wild West stuff on us. We're plain easygoing folks out here, and we don't like it. Drinks for the house are on you, stranger." Bean returned the preserving fluid to the tarantula jar, and the pseudo-Westerner breathed deeply. Although Bean considered it his legal and inalienable right to shortchange strangers at his bar, especially if these strangers were railway passengers, he deeply resented anyone's turning the tables on him. A passenger one day tried that. The whistle tooted, and all passengers at the bar hurried out. One short-legged imbiber wearing back east clothes and a handlebar mustache, was standing at the end of the bar nearest the door. When the whistle sounded, he placed his beer bottle on the counter and rushed out without paying for his drink. Roy did not detect this overt act until the place had emptied of passengers and the locomotive was puffing to a start. Near panic seized him as full realization of what had happened penetrated. In a single move, he tossed off his apron and adjusted his pistols at his waist. With a speed foreign to his usual easygoing manner, he leaped through the door, off the porch, and made a dive for the rear end of the departing train. With an effort, he grasped a bracket alongside the rear steps and flung himself to the platform. He reached upward and yanked the emergency cord. Brakes screamed and the train came to a stop. Bean unholstered his guns and stalked through the coaches. He scrutinized each passenger with a penetrating gaze. "It's all right, folks," he reassured the passengers as he entered each coach. "I'm only looking for an ornery polecat with a mustache." Finally, his search brought him face to face with the absconding customer. He covered him in decisive style. "Give me four drinks for that bottle of beer, you low-down, sneaking, dry-gulching SOB, afore I lose my temper." The handlebar mustache quivered. The passenger nearly ripped out his pocket in his haste to find some money. He handed the outraged bartender a dollar. Bean shoved the piece into his pocket. "Four bits for one bottle of beer. 4 bits collection fee," the judge commented as he holstered his guns and strode to the nearest exit. That's all the time we have for part one of The Niggeroon, the saga of Judge Roy Bean, Law West of the Pecos. We'll conclude this article next week on the Western Magazine Hour.
Thank you for joining us for the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Your narrator has been Jack. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.